I grew up in the Mormon Church. Born and raised, as they say. Even during the times of inactivity, I still considered myself to be a true believing Mormon. Times and people change, and when someone pushes you to reevaluate your beliefs, you sometimes realize how wrong you were. 2016 was the year I moved from Mormonville to Heathensburg. I'm Molly Ann Mormon. Welcome to Doubting Dogma, where I explore my new views and new friendships, moving on without religious belief. Good evening from Heathensburg Township, Pennsylvania. This is Doubting Dogma. I am Molly Ann Mormon. And joining me, because Riss is in Posicon right now, is a very special guest, one who also left the church. This is Greg Sullivan. Greg, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, so you are patron of the show, top patron.
Yep.
Good job. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And so since you wrote me an email and said, well, you know, I left the church as well, I was like, cool. Let's talk about it. So, like, where did you grow up? Were you, like, Utah Mormon? Or?
Indeed. I grew up in the Salt Lake Valley. I still live in Utah, just west of Salt Lake now. But I was out on the west side of the valley. I was born and raised in the church, just like you. You know, I was always active in Boy Scouts and priesthood. My dad was a bishop, stake president, high councilman. You know, I had a grandfather that was a patriarch. You know, we go back, at least on my mom's side, at least five or six generation Mormon.
Okay. Yeah, my mom was a convert. My dad was raised in the church. And somewhere down my dad's side, I guess it can be traced back to the pioneers that came over and everything. Because my aunt used to always tell us that if we wanted to, we could be part of the Daughters of the Pioneers and all this kind of stuff. And we're like, yeah, no, that's okay.
Yeah, I'm sure I could too, or at least my family. Yeah, a lot of my ancestors were the first white settlers of central Utah, specifically down in Richfield area. So we go way back, at least on that side. On my dad's side, it's a little newer. My grandmother was born in the church, but my grandfather was converted when my dad was very young. So, you know, it kind of goes a little bit shorter on that side, but we do go back pretty much to the beginning.
Just sorry, trying to figure out how I want to word this.
That's okay.
So, like, when you were growing up, were there any sort of discrepancies that kind of like made you look at the church funny, or were you just like all in hardcore like I was, where it's just like, nope, this is it because my parents said so?
Well, it was a little bit of both, I think. You know, with the leadership positions that my dad was in, we were always expected to, you know, be very active in the church. You know, I was always going to Boy Scouts and Mutual during the week. Seminary was expected. You know,
oh, yeah.
I graduated from seminary just like, you know, my dad expected. But there had always been questions in the back of my head that, you know, as they say, you put it on a shelf and just kind of forget about it for a while. It's the cognitive dissonance, I guess, that, you know, you don't want to think about, but you've always been told that it's true and you don't expect your parents to be wrong. And I know they fully believed it, but I had my doubts, but I'd always put them in the back of my head and just keep going because that was what was expected.
Yeah, and I know I was like, I was all set, I was ready, I wanted to go on a mission, and I was, you know, going to institute classes when I was going to college and all this kind of stuff, and now I look at where I am and where I was, and I just kind of laugh.
That's a common reaction, I think, at least with the ex-Mormons and I know. I look back at it, and I don't necessarily regret all of it, but I kind of wish I hadn't done all the things that I did, particularly mission service. You know,
I never ended up going on my mission because I went and joined the Army instead.
Right.
So, and but my sister did and everything.
And I would say that's probably a better use of your time long term. Like I say, I don't necessarily regret going. I do have a lot of good memories about my mission. I'm still in contact with a few people that I knew up there. And, you know, I learned a lot of life lessons, how to take care of myself, how to be independent. It was the, you know, constantly preaching and trying to convince other people to join the church that I look back now and kind of regret. At least, fortunately for me, the ones that I'm still in contact with that were converted or baptized, they've all left the church too. So I guess that's a silver lining.
You know, and I've heard people say that before. So yeah. They're like, oh, thank goodness. You know, I didn't have a lot of success, and the ones that I did get, they saw that it was a load of crap too. So
right. Well, you know, they believed it at some point, at least enough to become members of the church. But, you know, I do look back and think about some of the people that I taught, and I wonder how legitimately they actually believed it. And I don't think a lot of them did. I think for the most part, a lot of them were just coming in because of the community or they, who knows, but I don't think a lot of them actually believed it.
Yeah. And I mean, there's decent arguments for the community aspect and the benefits that it can have, but you can get that other places outside of the church and their misogyny and all the other just nonsense that goes with it.
Right. And that's something that I've kind of struggled with as I've left the church. I officially left back in 2003 is when I had my name removed from the church, but I'd been relatively inactive right back until about a year after I came home from my mission. And that would have been about 1996, roughly. Okay. And, you know, especially now, I drive truck for a living. I'm a long haul trucker. I don't interact with people all that often. So, you know, the community aspect of it is definitely a problem that I've had to address on my end. And I think a lot of it, you know, I turn to podcasts, different podcasts that I listen to while I'm on the road. I try to find like-minded individuals that I can relate to. And that's why I like your podcast so much, because I can see you going through a lot of the same steps that I did so many years ago.
Well, thank you. I'm still trying to sort stuff as I go, and it's still, like, it's super overwhelming when you think about it, but...
Well, yeah, it is. Absolutely. It's, you know, the Mormon church was a massive part of our lives. You know, at least in my case, it was everything.
It's all encompassing.
Absolutely. All of it. And when you stop and take a look at things objectively and then finally decide to walk away, you know, it's not just giving up your religion. You know, at least for me, I was looking at, well, my ancestors, they went across the plains. They settled Utah. I'm turning away from all of that. And that, you know, that's a hard thing to deal with. And there's so many other aspects too, that you're turning away from the family that you love. You're telling them that I don't believe what you've been teaching me. It's not an easy process. And I really respect anybody that's willing to put themselves out there and look at things objectively and make that decision to walk away, because it is a lot harder than most people think.
Yeah, and that's like one of the things I haven't been able to do yet is tell my family. And given the age of my parents, because, I mean, my dad is like literal baby boomer. He was born in 46, you know.
So right.
He is not a young man. And, you know, he's still healthy. He still goes for, you know, interval runs and this kind of stuff. But let's be realistic. I don't know how long they're going to be around. And the way that my parents are, And the way they, I mean, they put so much stock into it. You know, I mean, I don't want them to spend their last years thinking that they were a failure because, you know, I fell away from the church and my older sister is leaving the church and my little sister decided to become a Jew. And I mean, it's just, I just don't want to be that one, you know.
And I completely understand that. I never told my dad that I had my records removed, and he passed away about a year after I had it done. And, you know, I it happened so quickly when he died that I just didn't have a chance. But I did tell his parents, my grandparents, that I had left. There's not a whole lot of my family that I told, and they were about the only ones. All of my immediate family members knew, of course, but I had been fairly lucky in that regard because all of my siblings eventually ended up leaving anyway. So it wasn't too terrible for me when I left, and other family members had been going through the same thing I had as far as questioning and trying to figure out what the truth really was. So, you know, I look back at my dad and wonder, you know, maybe should I have told him at some point? I don't know. I don't have that answer. And unfortunately, that's something I'm never going to be able to answer. But, you know, on the other hand, it would have crushed him if I'd told him. So maybe, maybe it's better that I didn't.
And like, that's kind of my approach. Cause I mean, I hate confrontation and conflict and this kind of stuff.
Sure.
And I mean, that's been part of why it took me so long to leave the church is because I knew like how much of a disappointment it would be for my parents. And that's like always this huge thing that seems to be hanging over my head.
Sure.
Is the disappointed dad sigh, you know?
And there again, that's understandable, especially if your parents fully believe it and they're fully committed into the religion. You hope that as an adult, you're a good reflection of what they were raising you and, you know, maybe even better than what they were. So to actually go out and say that to them that, you know, I don't believe what you taught me growing up. I've walked away from it. I'm not turning back. I can't blame people for not doing that. I really can't because I can understand that. I didn't tell my dad.
Yeah, I just, it's just too much for me right now. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'll change my mind down the line, but right now that's kind of where I'm at. So, I mean, my sisters know that I left, but I didn't tell them why. So, but since they left, they don't really care to ask. So
sure.
Just leave it at that.
Well, and at least with my extended family members, a lot of them are still very active in the church, and most of them just don't address it with me. I think I've never really actually came out and told them that I left the church, but I think everybody in my extended family already knows, and nobody's really said anything or judged me for it. I've been very fortunate and lucky in that regard because I know that that's not always the case, particularly when the church goes as deep in our family as it has and still does.
Yeah. Now, I'm just wondering, where did you go for your mission?
I served in the Canada-Calgary mission. At the time, it was Calgary and Edmonton. They've split the mission since then. So I was there back 93 to 95 is when I went.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Isn't it as cold up there as I imagine it is?
It can be.
I mean, no offense to any Canadian listeners. I just, I don't like the cold.
Well, and the older I get now, I mean, this is, you know, what, 22 years since I've come home now. I can't handle the cold like now like I used to. But I do miss Canada. There were a lot of wonderful people up there. I loved the country, the scenery, everything about it. They, you know, if I could move back to Canada now, I would do so in a heartbeat.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, it does definitely get cold. I would say it's much like Minneapolis weather. I know Riz will be up there this winter. I don't know how how cold it gets back where you're at. But, you know, 40 below is not terribly uncommon in the winter. And you kind of adjust to it, I suppose.
I would die. A quick frozen little popsicle death. It would be horrible.
Yeah, it's not a lot of fun if you're not used to it. And, you know, with my job now, I run the lower 48, so I can end up in North Dakota or Minnesota or, you know, pretty much anywhere in the winter. You just deal with it, I guess, and move on and keep going.
Yeah, I mean, other than the past 3.5 years, because that's how long I've been here in Pennsylvania. Before that, I was in Texas for 12. So, I mean, you know, every time the winter comes around, I'm like, I miss Texas.
Sure. Hey, you were down in El Paso too, right?
Yeah, the desert.
Right. So, you know.
And the best Mexican food ever.
Oh, sure.
Love it.
Oh, sure. And honestly, that's one thing I always look for on the road. And it's very hard for me to find as good Mexican food. And I've noticed the further from the border you get, the harder it is to find really good Mexican.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, the next time you go through El Paso, over there, like, if you're coming off I-10, take the Trans Mountain exit, and you turn west, so you don't turn towards the mountains, you turn, like, if you're coming down from New Mexico, you'll be turning right.
Uh-huh.
And then follow that down to where it tees off, and there's this little place across the street there called Las Fuentes. And it is a great little restaurant. That's where we always used to go with my balloon crew after flights.
Excellent.
So we always go there for breakfast, and it's awesome.
I'll remember that. I'm always on the look for good food on the road. And, for me, it's mostly McDonald's and Denny's and Subway. So anytime I can get something else, it's a treat, really.
Oh, yeah. I love their breakfast. I get, like, the the eggs with the green chili and everything like that.
Oh yeah, the Hatch chilies.
It comes with the rice and the refried beans with the melty cheese on it, and they always give you the fresh made their flour tortillas. And, oh my gosh!
So yeah, that's that's kind of making me hungry too. That's the kind of meal that I just love.
Sorry.
Well, man, like I said, when you eat breakfast at Denny's almost every day, that gets old in a real hurry.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
So, what was the point at which you really started questioning everything? Like, what was the catalyst that led to that?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've thought about that a lot over the years. You know, I've talked to a lot of people. They had this one moment where it was just everything shattered for them, and that wasn't the case for me. It was more of a slow burn.
Yeah, I mean, because with mine, it was years of on again, off again, church attendance, and like not feeling like I belonged. And, you know, a lot of that was because here I am 31, so I'm getting kicked out of the singles ward. And
sure.
Then I'm in a family ward. And you know, I didn't get married till I was 35. So
well, I'm a bit older than you, and I'm not married yet, so don't feel too bad.
Yeah, see, like, and is there as much pressure for the guys as there is for the girls? I mean, I'm sure there is.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I still remember coming home from my mission. I had the final interview with the mission president, and he says, you know, I'm not telling you to go home and get married right away, but go home and get married right away. And I pretty well ignored him, which was probably a good idea. And this kind of goes back to where, you know, I started researching the church and where things really started to go south for me, because when I came home, I went to college. I wanted to get into the deeper aspects of the church. So I enrolled in institute classes, specifically with the Pearl of Great Price. And I think that was really where things started to head south for me very quickly. I'd always had a problem.
I took that one.
Yeah, after spending 2 years talking about the church, I kind of had the feeling that I knew a lot and I was ready to handle some of the deeper aspects of the church. And the deeper I got into the Pearl of Great Price, the more I realized that it was essentially made up by Joseph Smith, and the translation that we had didn't match the actual document. And, you know, I started looking at the Word of Wisdom and how wrong Joseph really got on almost all of it. And that led me to start questioning a lot of other things. And this was back before the days of the internet. So finding information was much, much harder than it is today. I mean, we've got all sorts of websites where you can go and look at, you know, exact copies of documents, and you can very easily figure things out. But back then I had to go out and look for, I suppose you would call it ex or anti-Mormon literature. It wasn't easily accessible, but I was able to find some. And the deeper I looked, you know, the harder things became to accept. So I can't say that it was one particular moment or one instance, but the deeper I got and the longer I studied all of this, the weaker and weaker the foundation of my testimony became until it just started to crumble.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that you had to, like, go out and search for it, because the way they always portray it, as soon as you step out the door, like, the anti-Mormon literature is, like, flying at you, like,
oh, like sure,
you're in a tornado, and it's all smacking you in the face, and you have to be all vigilant and not look at it and this kind of stuff. And I wonder, growing up in Utah there, because it's not the real world.
Definitely not.
Like, did they have a lot of that stuff in the public library, or?
I couldn't answer that because I never went looking for it when I was growing up. I just accepted things on face value. You know, my parents told me that it was true. Everybody, you know, all my leaders, my friends, they all believed it, and I just kind of went along with the pack. You know, it wasn't something that I went out looking for, but they definitely told us, you know, watch out for the anti-Mormon literature. It's evil. It's of the devil. You know, we got that constantly when I was up in Canada on my mission, and I came across a lot of it, but I didn't really pay a whole lot of attention to it at the time because I was just trying to do my time, be as good a missionary as I could, which sometimes worked, sometimes didn't, and just wanted to come home, start my life. And so I'd had some access to it on my mission, but before that, when I was growing up here in Utah, I never really saw anything like that.
So what sort of publications and stuff were you reading when you started researching all of it? Was it church-based publications?
Some of it. Some of it was. Most of what I found were from, boy, this is going back, I think it was the Lighthouse Ministries, which was down on Main Street and 13th South, roughly, in Salt Lake City. It was Gerald and Sandra Tanner, who had left the church and become evangelicals, and they did an awful lot of writing about the, you know, the history of the church and why it was all wrong. You know, I always remember hearing people saying that, well, they're just disgruntled Mormons. They wanted to sin. They wanted to, you know, do whatever. It's, you know, all the usual ideas that members get of why people leave the church. But they had a very extensive library that I was able to acquire, basically several different books that were very well researched, very well, you know, plenty of footnotes and documentation to back it all up. And that was a big part of what I was studying and what I was looking at in order to really make up my mind. And that was a time where I was starting to learn critical thinking, because before that, you know, even going through school, I'd never really engaged in it. I always just took what the teachers or the, you know, the leaders gave us as fact, and I never questioned it. I'm still fighting that to a certain degree. You know, I'm still trying to learn how to think critically and be skeptical about things. And that, you know, that goes right back to my childhood.
Yeah, definitely. It's certainly not a skill that they want to promote.
No. because, No, they always say, you know, when the prophet speaks, thinking has been done. And that's the way I was raised. If the prophet says something, you better do it. That's, you know, you're putting your soul at eternal risk if you don't. So, yeah, I didn't really consider any of that. I didn't look at things critically. And, it, you know, even 20 some odd years later, I'm still struggling with that on how to think critically and not take things at face value like I once did.
Yeah, and I think I brought this point up in episode 24 or 25, but I was talking to Riss, and I told her how, like, one of my young women's teachers had said, well, if the prophet says tomorrow that you're not supposed to eat apples anymore, it's not up for you to question why. You just don't eat apples anymore because, you know, even though science may say apples are great and everything, no, the prophet says you're not supposed to, and it might be for your health, and we just don't know it yet, or it's just to test your faith.
Exactly. So. And that's very, very much how I was raised. You know, you were always taught the prophet can never lead you astray, which, you know, I see now as, well, quite frankly, bullshit. You know, they don't know what they're doing, especially, you know, you look at how the church is even still fighting marriage equality. Those guys are not, oh, yeah. they're not inspired in any way in that regard. And I can see that now, but I know so many Mormons that, oh yeah, well, you know, this is what the prophet says. That's what we do. And it's very much a herd mentality. You know, you don't want to go against the grain and basically out yourself. So everybody just goes along with it because it's a path of least resistance.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that because they always try and portray following the prophet's teachings and being faithful in your Mormonism as being such a hard struggle, and that's going against the grain, and they just love to drive the persecution complex.
Oh, sure.
And, you know. And I don't know how much of that you saw in Utah, but I mean, like, because I grew up in Colorado, and we're not a huge group, you know. I was like, me and my sisters were the only ones at our high school. And
wow. So. Yeah, that's something I just can't, you know, relate to, because just about everybody I grew up with, you know, pretty much all of my friends were all LDS. All the male friends I had, everybody went on missions. That was just what was expected. We just did what we were supposed to. And yeah, there's definitely, and even still today, I still see a persecution complex going on that, you know, anytime somebody speaks out, particularly with politics, if they don't go along with the conservative Republican viewpoint that's so prevalent here in Utah, they, you know, somebody can, they'll really come after you if you're not careful, because, you know, everybody, they're all pretty much the same. Everybody thinks pretty much the same in that regard.
Yeah, and I also found it really interesting with the Mormon leaks a couple months ago leaked this little graphic that was supposedly I don't know if it was in the First Presidency's meeting or whatever, about these are the reasons that people are leaving the church. And sure. They're like, because they want us in, because of this, because of Denver Snuffer and all this kind of nonsense. And it's just like, you don't have, like, because it's a load of crap.
Exactly.
Trying to find it in one of these circles, and I can't. Maybe they hid it.
Exactly. And I always was raised that way, that if somebody left the church, they just wanted to sin. Or, I mean, you know, once you get a testimony, how could you ever turn away from that? And, you know, that was a big problem that I had to overcome when I was leaving the church, that, you know, have I been deceived by the devil? You know, am I down the wrong path? Because you always have that drilled into you that people are leaving because they were sinned. They wanted to sin. They were offended. Any other number of reasons aside from, well, maybe it's not true. That's the one thing that they never consider. And I still know a lot of LDS members that don't, you know, they might look at me and say, well, he left the church, but it never enters their mind that maybe I found out that it's not true. And that still goes very deep.
Yeah, and they have such a horrible tendency to prejudge and all this kind of stuff. I mean, they talk a real good game about, like, you know, don't judge anybody and welcome everybody and this kind of stuff, but they are just so judgy sometimes.
Of course they are.
Like, when I was planning my wedding and stuff, because I had I'd been engaged before I met my husband once. But anyways, but like trying to plan my wedding, I'm like trying to figure out what to do, because I'm like, well, I don't want to get married in the church by the bishop, because everybody's going to be like looking around and whispering and like, well, why isn't she getting married in the temple? What did she do?
Sure.
Kind of thing. And I was like, ugh, I just don't want to deal with that crap. So I don't know. That was, I have a lot of bitterness about this.
Of course. And that's understandable.
So, like that and the fact that I couldn't see my own sisters get married. So, at this.
Well, and I think that's a major problem, too. And it, you know, I always thought growing up that, well, if they can't go into the temple, it's their own fault. Maybe they should live a better life and blah, blah, blah. Now I look at it and think, boy, that's really offensive.
Yeah, like, well, when my sister got married, I was 19, so I couldn't go in.
Right, you weren't old enough.
Yeah, I mean, even if I was living, like, the perfect little Mormon girl life, the only way I'd be able to go in is if I had gotten married at, like, 18.
Right.
And, yeah, no. Just, no.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like I said, my dad was in fairly high local leadership positions, and I remember several times where he would perform civil ceremonies for people, and he'd always come home and say, you know what, it just, I'll do it, but I sure hate it. It's not the same, because you're not getting married for time and all eternity. It's so temporary. It's so wrong. And he was very judgmental about that. And I, you know, unfortunately, I gained a lot of those same tendencies when I was younger as well. And that takes a long time to kind of deprogram yourself from and walk away from, you know, to be able to look at something like that and say, you know what, this is, you know, they're getting married. It's a good thing. It doesn't matter what the context is. You know, you don't look at it and say, well, it should have been a temple wedding or whatever. As long as people are happy, I'm okay with it. It doesn't bother me.
Yeah. I mean, they need to just butt out, mind their own business, and quit trying to, like, rule everybody's life, like, the minutia of everything.
Of course.
That's the thing, because they're all just so ingrained, and they need to control all the little things, and I guess that's a huge reason why so many people do view the Mormon Church as a cult.
Well, and, you know, I've always kind of struggled with that.
Yeah, me too.
Mainly because I don't want to admit that I was actually part of a cult. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't know. You can talk to 20 different people about whether Mormonism is a cult and get 20 different answers, really. I think a lot of it really comes down to your personal experience with it. You know, I can certainly understand why people would feel that it's cult-like, because there's definitely a level of control that they try to try to enact on their members and even the non-members, particularly politically here in Utah, that, you know, that's kind of hard to get away from. And it's not very easy to defend a position that, yeah, they're not a cult.
Yeah. Now, speaking of that, there in Utah, like, I know I didn't fully understand it when I was a kid, but they had always said, well, you know, we can't tell you who to vote for and this kind of stuff.
Right.
Like, in Utah, though, like, did they ever try and, like, sneak any of that in, like, just a wink and a nod kind of thing and try and skirt around the Johnson Amendment? And
no, I didn't really see that so much. I do remember growing up, there was a ballot initiative. They were trying to legalize pari-mutuel betting, in other words, horse racing. And it had a fairly high amount of support, as I recall. I was fairly young at the time, until the church came out and said, yeah, we don't want this to pass. And it died very, very quickly thereafter. So, and we still see that in politics today, that if the church comes out and says something, that's pretty much the way it goes. That a couple of times medical marijuana has been up at the legislature, and a couple of times it got very close to passing until the church lobbied and said, yeah, we don't want this. So guess what happens?
And that still confuses me as to how Utah actually became one of the states where same-sex marriage was legal before the Supreme Court on it. And I'm just like, how did that pass there? I have no idea.
Well, if I can play Andrew Torres here for a minute, I'm not an attorney. I'm a trucker, but
I was going to say, I need to get Andrew Torres again and be like, how does the Mormon Church, how can they go and say, well, we ain't going to do this? Because if the church as an organization is speaking out against something, doesn't that just as much like Johnson Amendment infringement, or
generally it does, yes. But in the case of marriage equality, and I'm going off of memory here. It's been a few years back, but before the landmark Obergefell v. Hodges decision that legalized it across the country, about a year before that, Utah was involved in a case. It was called Kitchen v. Herbert. And Herbert being the moron governor that was in power at the time, still in power for that matter. And they were suing for marriage equality. And I think this was back, 2012, 2013. The state was fighting it. And it went to a district court in Denver. And a federal court in Denver overturned an amendment that had been voted on, a constitutional state amendment that had been voted on by the people, outlawing same-sex marriage. And the federal court said, yeah, you can't do that. It's against the 14th Amendment. You can't do it. So he threw it out. And immediately, that very same day, same-sex marriage started. I believe it was in December. But it was within minutes that people started going to the courthouses and started getting married. For whatever reason, the state attorneys that were fighting this did not stop to think that maybe they were going to lose and try to, you know, file for a stay on the decision. So it went into effect immediately. And then about 6 weeks later, they petitioned up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, yeah, okay, we'll put I'll stay in place on this ruling until we figure out what we're going to do with it. So that case went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, a year before Obergefell v. Hodges, they said, yeah, we're not going to listen to this case. So the district court in Denver, that ruling stood. Had it not been for that, you know, basically, Utah was forced kicking and screaming into the whole thing. They did not want it. They tried to fight it, and the Supreme Court says, "Yeah, we're just going to let it stay."
Yeah. See, because that always completely blew my mind. I was like, "Wait, what?"
Exactly. And I honestly never thought I'd see, at least in my lifetime, marriage equality in Utah, and it happened much, much faster than I ever considered it would. And I look at the same thing with, you know, the legalization of marijuana, medical or otherwise. I don't see Utah doing it until they're forced by the federal government to do it, just like they did with marriage equality.
Yeah, I don't see them doing that either.
But, you know, I keep voting against them. I stick in Utah just for that reason, so I can vote against the majority. D- doesn't do a whole lot of good, but at least I try.
Well, there you go. I could never move there. I'm like, it is some beautiful country, but I can't do Utah.
I love it. And, you know, I've been all the way across the country, and there's honestly nowhere else I'd rather live. I'm very happy where I'm at. The neighbors I have are really good. Fortunately, you know, I'm only home every 4 to 6 weeks anyway, so it's not like I'm home a whole lot. But, yeah. You know, I've got a good set of neighbors, good friends in the area, and, you know, I can't complain.
Well, that's always good.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, and this is where our roots go. I've talked to my brother about this a couple of times, and he's wanted to move out of Utah, but he can't because, you know, this is where our family is. This is where our friends are. You know, we've got the roots here. We've got our, everything's, you know, we're all pretty well entrenched here. So I don't see any of us leaving the state anytime soon.
Yeah, and...
And besides, you know, Nevada's only about an hour and a half away from where I live, so if we really want to have fun, it's not a big deal to head out west to Nevada and go, you know, just get away from the Utah culture for a while.
Well, yeah, from there it's, I mean, I know Reno's along that route, and, I mean, it shouldn't be too terribly far even to Vegas either.
From where I'm at, I can hit Vegas in a car in about 6-7 hours.
Okay.
I can hit Wendover, Nevada in about an hour and a half because it's just straight west. Reno would be more of a full day's drive.
Oh, is it? Because it's further south.
Reno is on the northwest end of Nevada. It's very close to the California border.
Okay, my family must have driven through there when we were going up to Oregon one time, so.
That's possible. I've gone to Oregon through Reno before, so it's certainly possible.
Yeah, I don't know. I was a kid. Only time I'd seen slot machines, because, like, you know, that's the devil, so, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that, when I was a kid, you know, my dad grew up in Southern California, so we went down to visit my grandparents usually about once a year, and we'd always drive through Vegas. And I remember one year my dad said, you know, I want to show you how fast you can lose your money on a slot machine. So I got a roll of nickels, like $2, and started throwing it in a nickel slot machine. And yeah, he kept winning. And we're like, wow, Dad, this is really cool. Can we do this too? No, this isn't the way it's supposed to work. It doesn't usually happen this way. That was the one and only time he ever tried that. And, well, I still play the slot machines occasionally, so I guess his lesson stuck.
Yeah, I just remember, like, Dad didn't even want to be walking through the casino area there that we had to go through in order to get to, like, the elevator to go up to our room.
Sure.
And this kind of stuff. And
yeah, we would... You know, a lot of the time we'd just drive straight through from Salt Lake to L.A. They didn't, you know, my parents didn't really care for Vegas. They didn't want to stop there if they could help it. But, you know, when you've got a bunch of little kids in a car, sometimes you don't really have much of a choice.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Are we there yet?
Exactly.
And when that minutes ago.
Right. And when that starts kicking in at hour three of a 12-hour trip, you know, not much you can do.
Yeah, so how many siblings do you have?
I've got three siblings. I've got two sisters and a brother. All of them,
okay.
We're all either inactive or completely out of the church.
Okay. Yeah, because I was like, well, you know, I was second out of five, so, you know, decent-sized little Mormon family there.
Yeah, it's a little small on the LDS side, but, you know, fairly average, maybe even a little big for everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I remember because we had so many kids, you know, we drove everywhere. So it was the family station wagon, mm-hmm. drove the suitcases up top and,
sure.
and the cooler in the back. And
yeah, you're trying to do it as economically as possible. That was the way we always did it. And I know my grandparents did the same thing when my parents were being raised. But, you know, you always take the sandwiches with you and, you know, you travel as lightly and cheaply as possible. And that's...
Yeah, and then whoever was in the backpack, as we called it, in that rear-facing seat.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they were on cooler duty because that's where the igloo was, so...
Right. Bring out the Diet Cokes and the sandwiches.
You're there trying to take a nap, and they're like, hey, I'm hungry. Can you make me a peanut butter sandwich? Right there, you know, so like you would switch out every time we stopped for gas, so you weren't constantly the one having to make everybody sandwich and stuff. So.
Exactly. And it was the only time we would stop was for fuel. That was it. You don't stop for any other reason. Let's just get down there and get this trip over with.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, those were some long drives.
Indeed. That was pretty much a yearly thing for us that we'd head down to Southern California. And a lot of people up here, that was, you know, a lot of the time that's where everybody went.
Yeah, because every summer we'd drive out to Utah because my dad's family is there, like around the Provo Orem area. So the family reunion was out there. And then
sure.
we'd also drive up to Yellowstone and. And we'd always go camping there for a week. And I mean, we'd occasionally go out to California or Oregon or Minnesota. And those were the long trips because those were a couple days.
Right.
So we were always really antsy by the time we got there. So.
Well, sure. It's, you know, I'm kind of used to it now. I drive, you know, 9 or 10 hours a day every day. It's not a big deal. But when you're a kid, that's brutal. You got to get out and burn some energy.
Yeah, and you don't have time because it's, okay, get up in the morning, and usually they tried to start when we were still sleeping, and they used to manage to do that when we were all still little tiny.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got bigger, and then, like, we couldn't leave before 10, and then it was 12, and then...
Right.
And Dad's there trying to pack the cooler, and he's like, "Oh, come on, I wanted to be on the road at 6, you know?"
Exactly. That's definitely the way it was in our family. And, you know, a lot of the time it was stressful because Dad just wanted to go. He didn't want to stop. He didn't, you know, if we stopped in a hotel, he didn't want me going down to hit the arcade or, you know, whatever it was that I wanted to do to unwind. It was, you know, we stop, we go to sleep, we wake up, and off we go again.
Yeah, and that was it. I mean, we'd occasionally, if we stayed at a hotel, which wasn't often, you know, but occasionally, you know, we'd have enough time to, like, go down to the pool and swim for a little bit.
Right. It wasn't much. I mean, the journey wasn't the big part of it. It was getting down to Southern California. You get to go to Disneyland or Magic Mountain or wherever. But, you know, it would have been nice. You know, all those years driving through Vegas, we never once stopped at the Hoover Dam, for instance. You know, I didn't see that until I was, well, probably 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah, I finally saw that when I was in the Army. So I saw that in 2002 was when I went and saw that.
Yeah, you know, and... Now, that's one thing that I kind of wish we'd done is, you know, stopped a little bit and slowed down and looked at the history of things and looked at, you know, the geographic landmarks, you know, especially southern Utah, northern Arizona with all the national parks that are down there. We didn't really spend any time going through those places, and I kind of wish we had.
Yeah, see, and those are some of the places like, you know, Zion and Bryce and Arches and stuff that I've never been to. Even though, you know, we would go to Utah every year, but we always spent it up there in the, I guess, northern third.
Right.
You know. And, I mean, it took me on my own, again, when I was in the Army. Well, same trip, actually, as when I saw the Hoover Dam, when I went to see, I think it was the western edge of the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
So...
And that's something I've never even seen yet. I've driven very close to it, but I've never stopped. And I do regret that.
Absolutely surreal. It is just because it's so deep, like your eyes just don't know what to make of it. They're just like, I can't comprehend the massiveness of this gorge in front of me. But it was really neat.
Well, and you know, I think it's very important to slow down and, you know, take a look around and look at, you know, I guess Ferris Bueller said it when, you know, life moves pretty fast if you don't slow down and you enjoy it. I can't remember exactly how he put it, but, you know, there's something to be said about that, to really look at your surroundings, look at the people, look at what's going around you, and just stopping to appreciate all of it. And, you know, we don't do that a whole lot.
Yeah, and I mean, I work like long hours, and I have a long drive up to where I work and everything. So my work week is pretty well shot just from the get-go.
Sure.
But I mean, I don't know. I do little stupid stuff that amuses me just because I'm a dork. And like if it, I don't know, I have coworkers that like look at me a little weird, like, we need to get her committed. But I mean, it's just, I try and find some pleasure in just the simple things of life, like the fact that I can get a pack of gummy cows at the convenience store.
Sure.
And they're little cows, and I'm like, moo.
No, not at all. I think, you know, anything you can do to make life a little bit better. You know, the further I get away from the church, the more I realize that the only thing that we leave behind is our memories, you know, what we did in life. And if we can leave the world a little bit better place and enjoy it while we're here, I think we're on the right path if we can do that. And so many people that are out there, they just don't see things that way. And I think that's unfortunate. You know, the world is a beautiful place. The universe is amazing. Stop and take it all in occasionally. I am a big fan of that.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I love, like, looking at nature and just seeing the beauty of it. And I mean, recently, I've talked a little bit about this. I've been volunteering at the Wildlife Preserve and Zoo that's about an hour from me. And I mean, getting to work with the animals, it just, oh, that makes my whole week.
Sure.
I come home and I'm like, Armando was sticking his nose out of the cage and he wanted his little armadillo face, like, pet, you know? I mean, I just have so much fun with it.
And that's an amazing thing. I'm honestly jealous of that because I don't have those opportunities to do a lot of volunteer work because I'm on the road all the time. And
yeah, like this is the first time I've ever like tried to do any of this. And it honestly probably wouldn't work if not for the fact that I have a compressed work schedule, meaning that I work 4/10s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always have a 3-day weekend. So I go in on Fridays when my husband's working anyway. So I'm like, yeah, this is a me day.
Right.
So I go and play with the critters.
Well, and those are the things that make life really, really special, I think. You know, it's being able to step back and look at the bigger picture. That's been a big advantage for me, just, you know, looking at even the smallest things. I wake up sometimes in the morning and see an amazing sunrise, and I'll just step back and look. Yeah, you know, stopping to smell the roses. People don't do that enough.
Yes, most definitely. And, in a little way, I'm sort of jealous that you get to drive all over the place and see so much stuff just along the way. But I don't want to drive a big car.
Well,
it scare me.
It can be terrifying if you're coming down a hill and it's snow packed and icy and you can feel the tires lose grip, Yeah, you know, you're 80,000 pounds going down a hill and you're not be able to control it, that can be, that can make your sphincter pucker in a real hurry. But, it, you know.
Well, seeing as how I don't even like driving my little car in the snow, and it scares me.
Well, you know, you get used to it after a while, but it's something that I really enjoy doing because I can look back at the end of the day and say, you know, I've actually done something productive. You know, I've, it's hard to do that in a lot of jobs. For years, I was working in customer service and, in, you know, that didn't really have any fulfillment for me, but this job does.
I gotta say, that's probably a big part of why I'm so like not happy with my current job. Best part is that I have a compressed work schedule.
Exactly.
I can go play with the animals.
Well, and that's a big plus too. You know, I consider myself very lucky in that regard because, you know, so often you go to work and you do your job because you need money. You know, that's what we all have to do. But, you know, if you can really enjoy it, I think you're one of the fortunate few. And I really consider myself very fortunate in that regard because I do love my job.
That is awesome.
Well, and the nice thing is too, you know, a lot of the time when I wake up in the morning, I have no idea where I'll end up at night. That's kind of fun.
I would be freaking out this time of year. Well, snow already hitting some of the northern and higher elevated states and stuff.
I've driven through a few snowstorms already up through Donner's Pass in California. I hit some snow a few weeks ago. Hit some snow in Wyoming not long ago. It's definitely coming. Winter's on its way. I definitely prefer summer, but you know, it kind of goes with the territory, I suppose.
Yeah, of course. I suppose with summer, when you're long haul trucking, I mean, then you have to deal with the Wyoming state trees. That is to say, the orange construction cones.
They're all over the place, and they have actually just started coming down. Thankfully, in not only Wyoming, but in a lot of other states too. Unfortunately, you get down to somewhere like Dallas where everything's under construction all the time and that never goes away.
Yeah, my husband always says that Pennsylvania should just have on their welcome to Pennsylvania sign, it should just say, the state is currently under construction. Please excuse the mess.
Exactly. Well, and Pennsylvania, that's the only state I know of that requires you to turn your headlights on in construction zones. So anytime I cross into Pennsylvania from Ohio or Maryland or wherever I'm coming in from, I just turn the headlights on and forget about it. Because there's just so many construction zones, you might as well. It's just not worth fighting.
Yeah, that, and it's like, because the winter is so long, and our Canadian listener is going to laugh at me, but because the winter is so long to me, soon as it starts warming up, it's construction season until it gets all cold again.
Sure, so, they don't waste time on that.
Yeah, I mean, well, just like I-80 in Wyoming, because, I mean, they really can't allow any sort of variance to their schedule with that because it's so short.
Yeah, the construction season is very, very short, especially in Wyoming, so they got to take advantage while they can. I drove across Wyoming just a couple of days ago, and fortunately, it was all pretty well wide open now. Most of the construction projects are done, but, you know, like I say, you still end up down in the south where they can run construction year-round, and we're still going to see it.
Yeah, I think they still, like, decide to take random days off, though, just because they're like, well, the guys up north don't have to.
Exactly. Well, I personally think they're just trying to mess with us because they can. and mainly because that's exactly what I would do if I were in that position. Yeah, you know, you got to have fun at life. And sometimes, it comes at the expense of others, but, you know, I guess that's the way it goes sometimes.
Yeah, and I know driving across Wyoming or, like, when we headed out to Minnesota, and we would drive through like Iowa, and like those just all look the same plains kind of states. It was always fun going in the convenience stores there, because they would have like all the postcards,
uh-huh.
and we'd always go through looking for the funny ones. And two or three states all had the same one, and it was all jokes about construction. You know, the state tree, the state joke being men at work, and you know,
yeah, exactly. That happens in just about every state. You know, some are better than others. The joke among truckers is that, you know, Illinois is so bad that you're amazed any freight can get across the street, the state, in at all. Because some of it can get really, really bad, and they like to slow you down to 35, 45 miles an hour.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of that going on in Wyoming, too.
Oh, yeah.
They tend to slow those down.
Well, and let's face it, Wyoming, driving across Wyoming is not all that interesting.
Well, no, that's why you need the speed to be higher, because otherwise you get bored, you look around, and then you crash.
I agree. Yeah. Absolutely. I can understand that, because I'm always on the watch for people that are doing that.
Well, then, I'm just curious, because I think last time I went across Wyoming, it was 75 on the interstate. Is mm-hmm. it 80 now?
It is.
In Texas.
There's a lot of the western states have moved up to 80. Utah was one of the first. I think Idaho has as well, although it's been a while since I've been up there. Wyoming, definitely. You know, people out west like to go faster, and I don't blame them. There's not a whole lot of traffic. It's not that big of a deal.
That, and the quicker you can get across that flat part of Wyoming, the better.
Exactly. You know, and then what really sucks for me is the truck I drive is speed limited at 65 miles an hour, so... That's
you have a governor.
Yep.
Oh, fun.
Those are very common in the trucking industry anymore. Most trucks are governed 62, 65, 68.
Yeah, except the ones that pass me on 81 over here.
I have driven down there, and I know a lot of truckers can really get moving down there. I'm not one of them.
Well, thank you. Because, like, I will tell this story. Like, a month after I got my very first car, when I was in the Army, I got a little Honda Civic. And me and my boyfriend were going up to White Sands National Monument.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going up US 54. And it was a construction zone, you know. And so they had it all back down to speed limit 45. So I was going 45. And this truck was riding my ass and didn't like it. And then he, as soon as, like, there was a break in the cones, he went and passed me. And as he came over, like, he hit my car with his wheel.
Wow.
And, like, I swerved it. And so, like, please take no offense at this. I've, like, just been at truckers ever since.
No, I understand that. I do. I mean... Anytime my brother sees a trucker do something stupid, he blames me.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. And that happens at least a couple of times a day for him. I understand that there's a lot of bad drivers out there, but, you know, a lot of people like me, we try to do our best, take safety seriously. We're not in any hurry. We're just kind of going. But
yeah, and I mean, I try and do what I can, like, because they are super big, obviously. So, you know, I try and leave them room to merge when they try to and this kind of stuff.
But, and we definitely appreciate that. I know I do. Anytime that, you know, someone, because we can't accelerate. We don't stop very well. It's 80,000 pounds, and that it takes a lot of time to get moving and a lot of time to get stopped.
Yeah, that's just... Oh, I so would not want to drive one of those, so kudos to you.
Thank you. I really enjoy it. I think this is more or less my calling as far as, you know, professional work goes.
Well, there you go. But, okay, well, we've been yammering for about an hour now, so...
It's been a wonderful conversation. I've had a lot of fun.
Was there anything else you wanted to say?
Not that I can think of. If anybody wants to check out my writing, I tend to ramble a little bit, but I own a website. It's leavingthemormons.com. I go into a bit more detail on my story, mainly because I didn't have any access to things like this when I was leaving the church. And, you know, hopefully somebody can find some comfort in realizing that they're not alone. You know, the path you're going down is the same that so many others have gone before you, and many will go after that. So there are some resources out there that can help.
Awesome. I will definitely link that in the show notes so people can go and check that out and read it. And I was not aware of this, so I'm going to go and look at it sometime too. So
excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining me and telling your story and joking around about construction.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, and thanks everybody for listening, and we will talk at you next week. I want to thank you for joining us. If you like what you hear, please consider supporting the show on Patreon at patreon.com/doubtingdogma or leave a review on iTunes. You can follow the show on Facebook at facebook.com/doubtingdogma or on Twitter at doubtingdogma. The intro music was written and performed by Marissa Alexa McCool and was used with her permission.